A few years ago, when I was in college, working on the original Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities podcast, I worked at a summer camp. It was fun, a little draining, but very rewarding. I learned that I love working with children, and I also learned that young children are weird as hell. During one of my last weeks at the camp, there was a kid in my cabin group who was intent on saying something more impressive than whatever one particular other kid said. If the other kid said, "I once ate an orange with the peel on," this one kid would say, "I once ate a banana with the peel on." If the other kid said, "My grandma died before I was born," this one other kid would say, "My parents died before I was born." Life around these kids was a constant drumbeat of, "Oh yeah, well I..." The kid who kept being upstaged was never too annoyed by it and found it funny, which everyone else did too, so I never put a stop to it. One day, at lunch, the kid who was Mr. I'm More Interesting Than You's target said, out of nowhere, "I once saw a llama on an island." So naturally, Mr. I'm More Interesting Than You responded, "I once saw two llamas on two islands." I thought this was so funny that I said, "I once saw three llamas on three islands," and the race was on. The other kids began chiming in with all the llamas they'd seen, each standing on their own personal llama island. We passed 5 llamas on 5 islands, 10 llamas on 10 islands, 100 llamas on 100 islands, then jumped all the way from 1,000 llamas on 1,000 islands to 1,000,000 llamas on 1,000,000 islands. The pile of llamas grew predictably from there, past 1 billion llamas, through a few well-known but non-existent numbers like 1 gazillion llamas and 1 bajillion llamas, until one kid took the plunge and said he'd seen 1 Google llamas on 1 Google islands. Let's pause here with our Google llamas. Most people know, intellectually, how much 1 Google is. It's 10 to the 100th power, 1 with 100 zeros. But how many llamas is that? It's probably unsurprising to learn that there are not 1 Google llamas on Earth. There aren't 1 Google islands either. In fact, there isn't really 1 Google of anything. There aren't even 1 Google atoms in the observable universe. Given astronomers' current estimates of the size of the universe, there's somewhere between 10 to the 78th power and 10 to the 82nd power atoms in the observable universe, which sounds reasonably close to 1 Google on the surface, but remember how those tricky exponents work. Even going with the upper bound of 10 to the 82, we would need 1 quintillion universes to get to 1 Google atoms. About as many universes as there are grains of sand on Earth. Now, it's possible that's wrong. The universe could instead be infinite. If the universe is infinite, not only are there definitely 1 Google atoms in it, there are definitely 1 Google llamas on 1 Google islands. There's definitely a planet that's nothing but a shallow ocean with llamas standing on islands. There's definitely 1 Google of those planets. In an infinite universe, everything that can happen under the laws of physics would happen an infinite number of times in an infinite number of places. Therefore, there would be infinite worlds that happened to end up exactly like Earth, complete with our same animals and our same landforms. In total, there would be far more than 1 Google llamas on 1 Google islands. But the universe probably isn't infinite, it's just unimaginably vast. But not as unimaginably vast as 1 Google. Let's return to our llamas and our islands. The conversation over lunch at camp was heating up. 1 Google wasn't the biggest number these kids knew. After 1 Google had been brought out, the original kid who started the Llamas on Islands game dropped an even bigger bombshell. He had seen 1 Googleplex llamas on 1 Googleplex islands. He'd just taken this up so many notches. 1 Googleplex is 1 with 1 Google zeros. Consider just how many times larger this is than 1 Google. 100 zeros may be a lot, but you could write 1 Google on 1 page of a pocket notebook. It would probably take about 1 minute or so. There isn't enough space in the entire universe to write 1 Googleplex. If you printed zeros at 10-point type over every possible flat surface in the universe, the walls of the room you're in right now, the ice on Europa, the roofs of every village schoolhouse in Cameroon, the asteroids in the Kuiper Belt, all the pages of every book ever written, the surface of barren planets in distant galaxies, the full extent of the Australian outback, you'd still be a fraction of the way toward writing 1 Googleplex. That's not how big the quantity itself is, that's just what it takes to write the number Googleplex in conventional notation. Picture that. Now, picture, in comparison, how easy it is to write 100 zeros. That's how much larger 1 Googleplex is than 1 Google. But then, I shut down their silly little game and won, once and for all. I said I'd seen a Graham's number of llamas on a Graham's number of islands. What is Graham's number? How big is that? I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. There is no biggest number. I hope that's abundantly clear. The whole point of numbers is that they go on forever, because conceivably, there's an infinite quantity of things you can count.
I f*** the spiders on the wall. I f*** the cobwebs in the hall. I f*** the candles on the shelf. When I'm alone, I f*** myself.
But, as I've shown, there is a point where you run out of candles, spiders, puppet vampires, and, yes, llamas to count. In a finite universe, there is a finite number of things you can describe with numbers. Beyond that point, numbers become basically useless, because nothing is that big. So in a way, there is a biggest number. What is that point? Where do numbers get too big to exist? Graham's number is a decent candidate. None other than the Guinness Book of World Records has certified Graham's number as the biggest number ever used in a mathematical proof. And while the Guinness Book of World Records isn't as reliable a source as they'd like you to think, it's true that when Graham's number was published in 1977, it was the biggest number most mathematicians had ever come across. Graham's number was first calculated by Ronald Graham, who was working on an extremely niche, esoteric problem with very few applications in the real world, as you do when you're a pure mathematician. An oversimplification of the problem would go something like this. Suppose you have a whole bunch of people and they're all divided into several different groups. Doesn't matter how many groups there are, and some people can be in multiple groups at once. Now, start drawing lines between the groups of people so that every group is connected with every other group by one line and one line only. Color some of the lines blue and some of them red. It doesn't need to be evenly 50-50 red and blue. Any combination is fine. Your question is, what is the minimum number of total people possible so that there are at least four groups and all four groups are linked to each other by lines of the same color and everyone is in an even number of groups? This is not the problem Graham was working on. For one thing, his problem involved n-dimensional hypercubes, which sounds like a MacGuffin in a Marvel movie, but is actually a thing that serious mathematicians sit around and think about, including my grandfather and namesake, the original Tor Parsons. N-dimensional figures were sort of his thing. He was a personal friend of Ronald Graham, in fact. Anyway, I'm definitely making my grandfather roll over in his grave by saying this, but you can take out the n-dimensional hypercubes and replace them with groups of people, and the problem that leads to Graham's number is still roughly the same. So, Graham found that, understandably, the minimum number of people for this to be possible varies a lot, depending on, among other things, how many lines you color red and how many lines you color blue. He was able to establish bounds on the problem, though. The smallest possible minimum number of people was 6. The largest possible was Graham's number. So, how did he calculate Graham's number?
Oh yeah, I slowly, slowly, slowly getting faster. Once I start in it's very hard to stop.
The simplest way of starting with a small number and getting to a bigger one is just counting. 1, 2, 3, you know the deal. But you could add the numbers together instead and grow at a much faster rate. Consider adding 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 3. Look, you've gotten to 12 already with only 4 numbers. Then, of course, there's multiplication. 3 × 3 × 3 × 3 gets you to 9 × 3 × 3, which gets you to 81. We're out of the world of linear growth now, Toto. We're in exponential land. You could obviously write 3 × 3 × 3 × 3 as an exponent, 3 to the 4th. But from there, we can get into operations that grow even faster than ordinary exponents, something called tetration, where you stack exponents. Check this out. 3 to the 3rd power to the 3rd power to the 3rd power. A tower of powers, if you will. You evaluate these from the top down. So in the case of 3 to the 3 to the 3 to the 3 to the 3, you can turn this into 3 to the 3 to the 27. So now your exponent is 3 to the 27th power. 3 × 3 × 3 × 3, etc. 27 times. It shouldn't be a surprise that this is a huge number. It works out to around 7.6 trillion, and we're not done yet. We now need to raise 3 to the 7.6 trillionth power. This results in a number with 3.6 trillion digits. If I added just one more 3, we'd get to a number way bigger than a Googleplex. And that's just powers of 3 stacked on top of each other 4 times. The way mathematicians write situations like this is with the number being stacked, 3 in our case, then an up arrow, then the number of times it's being stacked, 4 in our case. That innocuous equation results in a 3.6 trillion digit number. You look at a tetration equation like that, and you're likely to say, what horrible tortures did that up arrow inflict on that 3? How do you get a number so big from just 3 up arrow 4?
Faster, faster, it is so exciting, I could forever until I drop.
You can do even swankier shit than this. I promise we'll get around to Graham's number soon. The next operation up, no, we are not stopping yet, is called pentation. Pentation works like this. You have a bunch of towers of powers next to each other. The first one has as many levels as the number being raised that many levels. That is 3 to the 3 to the 3, or 4 to the 4 to the 4 to the 4, or 5 to the 5 to the 5 to the 5 to the 5. You get it. Then, whatever the outcome of this first power tower is, becomes the height of the next power tower. The height! Consider that just 3 stacked 3 times is 7.6 trillion. So imagine how big the result of 3 stacked 7.6 trillion times must be. Actually, don't imagine that. Humans aren't made for numbers this big. It's literally impossible to imagine. Then, once you have that unimaginably vast number, you can, if you want, make that number the height of another power tower. The world is your oyster. Nothing's stopping you from adding more. This, again, can be innocuously written using arrows. 3 towers of powers involving 3s can be written as 3, then 3 up arrows. The result is a number so much bigger than a Googleplex that the difference between a Googleplex and 1 is negligible. One more step. The way you can combine numbers to make addition, and combine adding numbers to make multiplication, and combine multiplying numbers to make exponents, and combine exponents to make power towers, and combine power towers to make pentation, you can combine the chains of power towers you use in pentation in a process called hexation. In hexation, you start with a chain of power towers, each one feeding into the next, and then the outcome to the first chain of power towers becomes the number of power towers you use in the next turn. So, suppose you have 3 power towers of 3. The unimaginably huge number that results from that becomes the unimaginably huge number of power towers in the next chain. As you can predict, hexation is written using 4 up arrows. A 3 followed by 4 up arrows, then a 3 means a chain of 3 power towers, then 2 more increasingly butt-fuckingly huge chains of butt-fuckingly huge power towers. At this point, trying to make sense of the size of these numbers is useless. We've progressed past the mouth gaping open, oh my god, these numbers are too large stage. By now, not only is the number of atoms in the universe vanishingly small in comparison, the number of Planck volumes in the universe is a drop in the bucket too. Planck volumes are the smallest possible space. Yes, that's a thing in physics. You can think of that as the pixel resolution of the universe, and an average atom is 10 to the 60th power times larger than one of them. For comparison, the Milky Way galaxy is about 10 to the 21 times larger than Jollibee the Durian. So when I said there wasn't a Google of anything in the universe, I wasn't quite telling the truth. There's far more than a Google Planck volumes. But by now, we're dealing with numbers that have more digits than there are Planck volumes in the universe. There isn't even any use gawking at these. you kind of just have to accept that these numbers are huge and there's no way to wrap your mind around them. And we haven't even gotten to Graham's number yet. But we can calculate Graham's number. The first term of Graham's number is a number called G1. G1 is the result of a hexation equation. 3, up arrow, up arrow, up arrow, up arrow, 3. A chain of 3 impossibly gigantic power towers, then an impossibly gigantic chain of even more gigantic power towers, and then an even bigger chain. It's easy to think of all big numbers as being created equal, but let's just say that if you estimated you had a Graham's number of llamas, then you counted them and were off by G1, you'd still be right on the money. That difference would be negligible. In fact, it's so negligible that guessing a Graham's number and being off by a difference of G1 is freakishly accurate. It's like throwing a baseball to a planet orbiting Alpha Centauri, aiming for one specific stitch to impact one specific grain of sand, and getting the next grain of sand over. Currently, without having fully detailed how we get to Graham's number, G1 is definitely the biggest number you've ever heard described. But compared to Graham's number, it's tiny. Once you've got G1, you go for G2. G1 is written as 3, then 3 up arrows, then another 3. G2 is written as a 3, then G1 up arrows, then another 3. I'm gonna pause to let you consider that. All right, well, turns out you can't consider it, but what you do to go to G2 from G1 is you take the chain of power towers you used to get G1, and you make that into a chain of chains. G1, chains of power towers. And then you make chains of those chains of chains, and chains of those, and so on until you have chains of chains of chains of chains of chains, etc., nested G1 times. Once you have G2, you do the same thing a G2 number of times to get G3. Each rate grows at a rate way beyond exponential growth. To get Graham's number, you have to go all the way to G64. That's Graham's number. A number so high, there's no word for it. A number so high, the number of digits in the number expressing how many digits it has would be too large to fit in the universe. Planck volume by Planck volume. Probably the largest number anyone, including mathematicians, will ever encounter.
Faster, faster, it is so exciting. I could forever until I drop. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, I love whatever the amount. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hey, yeah, 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 yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, that's his song. Oh, the count.
Of course, once I'd gotten there, my campers, if they were sharp, could have defeated me by saying, I've seen a Graham's number plus one llamas on a Graham's number plus one islands. Graham's number isn't the biggest number, obviously, but it is a number that really matters in a process with some real-life applications, possibly. And there may be no bigger number that fits that bill. My main source for this episode, Dave Sinha, the head of the University of Oregon Math Department, has this fantastic analogy. So, we here in Oregon, we pride ourselves in growing big pumpkins. There are national contests for who can grow the biggest pumpkins, and Oregonians often win. But these pumpkins are specifically bred to be gigantic. Giant pumpkin growers share techniques, some have trade secrets, they pump them full of fertilizer, they do everything they can to make their pumpkins huge above all else. If you've grown a 2,000-pound pumpkin, yeah, that's impressive. But it's even more impressive if you were just growing pumpkins without caring about their size, just growing them for pies or jack-o'-lanterns or whatever, and it just so happened that one of your pumpkins grew to 2,000 pounds. That's what Graham's number is like, says Sinha. Some people have tried to come up with functions that create absurdly large numbers simply for the purpose of creating huge numbers, but Graham wasn't trying to do that when he came up with Graham's number. He was trying to solve a real-life math problem, and that turned out to be the upper bound. You can probably make numbers that are as arbitrarily huge as you want, but Graham made an insanely huge number without intending to. That's why Graham's number matters so much. It's like a pumpkin naturally growing to this size without trying to make it the biggest pumpkin. It serves a purpose beyond just being huge. All right, so in this analogy, who are the giant pumpkin growers of the math world? A select few in the amateur field of Googology. The study of large numbers. The Googology community, if such a thing can be said to exist, is nebulous, and its primary record is a fandom wiki page comprising a remarkable 13,042 pages, which is fittingly a large number. Examples of the topics of Googology Wiki pages include 1. A ugrete duplex, for which the article helpfully notes the name of this number is based on the suffix t-duplex and the number a ugrea. Absolutely godly ultimate omega mega super even more godder tri-tri. A name that was apparently coined by Googology user Hayden the Googologist 2009. Beeping busy beaver function. Actually, remember that one for later. Big ass number, which is a defined series of functions. Dim sum, another number named by Hayden the Googologist 2009. A series of numbers collectively known as Flannery of Ukrainian Town. Googology Wiki can have an article with any gibberish if it's assigned to a number, a page title that is, wait for it, the name of an actual number. Graph. Southwest Bacon Whopper, also known as a Decadohectaculus, Spookbillion, and, my absolute favorite, onion-infused multidimensional beef. Beef is supposed to be written in all caps. God, I love autism. If anyone could be expected to have the largest name number in their sights, it would be this crew. And here we have to set some ground rules. Clearly, we're not trying to find the largest number, nor are we just trying to name some absurdly large number. For example, now that I understand the power tower process that gets you up to Graham's number, recognizing that Graham's number is G64, I could now create a number that dwarfs Graham by going up to G Googleplex. Or, hell, nothing's stopping me from going to G Graham's number. There we go, recursive Graham's number. If that number doesn't already have a batshit bonkers name on Googology Wiki, which it probably does, I'm gonna call that the Jollibee the Durian number. But as huge as that number probably is, it isn't a candidate for the largest named number. Any fool can go on Googology Wiki and say, I know a number bigger than Graham's number plus one! So, for that reason, the candidates for the largest named number need to be reached by their own specific mathematical process. You can't just piggyback on the process that you use to reach some other big number. You can't math together a bunch of existing big numbers and call that a new big number. That's not a named number. That's what the Googology community calls a salad number. You're not putting in the effort to make a new number, you're just throwing in a bunch of numbers together. You can do that as much as you want, because of course, numbers are infinite. The actually interesting question is, what is the largest number we can define using math? In 2007, just for fun, a pair of professors, Augustine Ryo of MIT and Adam Elga of Princeton, held a big number duel. The rules were simple. Elga wrote a number on a chalkboard, then Ryo wrote a number that's bigger than it. The duel ended when one of them couldn't come up with a number that they could be sure was larger than the one their opponent just named. Every number had to have a value that was, at least in theory, calculable. No writing hypothetical undefined numbers like the biggest number my opponent can think of plus one. Nothing infinite, and no salad numbers. If your opponent wrote a Graham's number, you couldn't say a Graham's number to the Graham's number power. The participants in the duel had to show that they knew their shit about math by doing something original with each turn. Some new process had to be introduced each time. It started with Elga writing the number 1 on the board. Starting small, a journey of 1,000 miles and all, Ryo just then added a bunch more ones, 30 or 40 from most sources I've heard, so that the board was entirely covered by ones. Big number? Yeah, sure, but then Elga one-upped Ryo, pun intended, in a way that, if I'd been there, even if I'd been a world-class mathematician, would have made me throw down my chalk and concede defeat.
This guy might be better than me.
You're right, I am better than me.
It's not that it was a particularly big number, still probably way smaller than Graham's, or even G1 of the sequence that leads to Graham's, but no mathematician could ever match the sheer stylishness of what Elga did. He licked his finger and erased a line across most of the ones in the number, turning them into exclamation points. He had changed a long number composed of ones into 11 factorial, 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 on and on and on, which was, of course, way bigger. 11 factorial with just one exclamation point, 11 times 10 times 9 times 8 and so on, is in the neighborhood of 40 million. Then try doing another factorial of that, and then doing a factorial of the result of that, so on, about 30 or 40 times. He had already taken this into the realm of numbers too large to write in the universe. Ryo was cornered. If this had been WWE, the folding chair would have been right about to come down over his head. Then he remembered something, and he went to the board and wrote, "Busy Beaver function of a Google. I told you we'd get back here, right?" Busy Beaver functions show that the tradition of giving outrageous names to giant numbers isn't limited to a bunch of janky nerds on the internet, because the name Busy Beaver goes all the way back to 1962, and it's the best known example of a non-computable function. What do I mean by non-computable? You could say that the function that leads to Graham's number is non-computable because it grows so damn fast. There aren't a lot of computers in the world that could evaluate a power tower of 3 stacked 7.6 trillion times, and that's just the first of a lot of steps on the way to getting Graham's number. Now, that hints at something fundamental about all these gigantic numbers, but I'll get to that later. What you should be getting from this right now is that that doesn't mean non-computable. A function that grows too fast for an ordinary computer to evaluate it isn't non-computable, because hypothetically some mega supercomputer in the distant future could evaluate it. A planet-sized Matryoshka brain would be able to calculate Graham's number in a jiffy. But there are some functions that are non-computable in a weirder, much more eerie way. It's in the nature of these functions that they are impossible for a computer to calculate. Naturally, these are functions that involve computers themselves. Alan Turing, the father of modern computing, conceived of something called the halting problem. The idea is you've got a computer that you program to do something using a binary input. Ones and zeros on a modern computer, or hole punches and not hole punches in a tape in Turing's days. Some programs might finish at some point, which is called halting, while others might get into a loop and repeat, going on forever. So, how can you tell whether a given input for a program will halt or not? Amazingly, Turing proved that you can't, at least not using computers you can't. His conclusion was, if there was an algorithm that could examine any input and determine if it halts or not, you could program it to run forever if it halts, and halt if it runs forever. And clearly that's not possible. It's like a computing equivalent of the old brain tickler, "this sentence is a lie." A really simple program, like, say, "print Jollibee the durian is a bitch-ass motherfucker," is pretty easy to evaluate. Obviously, it halts after printing "Jollibee the durian is a bitch-ass motherfucker," but for a more complicated program, one that has real-world applications, the only way to determine if a program will halt or not is to run it and see. If it eventually halts, there's your answer, but if it keeps going, that's not proof that it goes on forever, because you can't be sure it won't eventually halt at some point. In order to tell if a program will halt, you need some hardcore math. Enter the Busy Beavers. The Busy Beaver function was created in 1962 by a guy named Tibor Rado, who wasn't even an Oregon State graduate, so God knows where he got that name for this function. Maybe he's an ancestor of Hayden the Googologist 2009. The genesis of the Busy Beavers comes from how every computer program needs to have a certain number of rules. For instance, "print Jollibee the durian is a bitch-ass motherfucker" is a program with one rule that takes one step and then halts. "Print Jollibee the durian is a bitch-ass motherfucker and continue" is a program with one rule that takes infinite steps and never halts. "Print Jollibee the durian is a bitch-ass motherfucker, generate a random number between 1 and 10, and if the number is odd, continue" is a program with three rules that takes an undefined but finite number of steps. Of course, most programs have lots and lots of rules. Some of them halt and some of them don't. Tibor Rado asked the question, what is the maximum finite number of steps a program that halts can take before halting if it started out with n rules? The max possible number of steps that a halting program with n rules can take is called the nth Busy Beaver number. The Busy Beaver function is inherently non-computable because a computer can't figure out when it will halt, and it grows faster than any other function in existence. Even those power towers that we worked with earlier on are no match for these Busy Beavers. It's pretty obvious that the first Busy Beaver number, that is, the maximum possible number of steps for a halting program with one rule, is just one. All programs with one rule are either something like "print Jollibee the durian is a bitch-ass motherfucker" or "print Jollibee the durian is a bitch-ass motherfucker and continue." Either it has one step or it goes on forever. Mathematicians have discovered that the second Busy Beaver number, the max number of steps a program with two rules can take before we can be sure it'll never halt, is 6. just six? That's not very impressive. A lot of mathematical busy work, since you can't use computers on these problems, led us to a proof of the third busy beaver number in 1965. It's 21. That is, if a computer program with three rules has gone on for more than 21 steps, it'll go on forever. It took all the way until 1983 to prove that the fourth busy beaver is 107. The fifth busy beaver wouldn't be confirmed for 40 years. An amateur mathematician in 1984 found a five-rule program that goes on for 2,133,492 steps and then halts. Just 5 years later, a five-rule program was discovered that only halts after 47 million steps. In 2024, it was proven to be the largest possible five-rule program, making it the first time in my lifetime a new busy beaver was confirmed. We know that the sixth busy beaver is at least 8.6 quadrillion, and possibly larger. As smirk-inducing as the busy beaver name is, I find the idea of busy beavers to be kind of scary. The idea that there are details of machines we've built that we can't fully understand just doesn't sit right with me. With the rise of AI, unexplainable phenomena within computers are increasingly becoming part of pop culture. Look up Loeb, for instance. L-O-A-B, Loeb. I promise you won't be disappointed. Other unwanted emotions maybe, but not disappointed. But before Loeb, there were the busy beavers, the original ghosts in the machine. Now let's return to the big number duel. Ryo had written the Google busy beaver number, a number we don't know the exact value of and almost definitely never will, but is certainly finite with an exact value and a huge-ass number. Now Elga was the one backed up to the wall. What number could he possibly write that was definitely bigger than that? He did something that I personally consider a cop-out, barely any better than doing a salad number. He introduced the idea of super Turing machines, a hypothetical type of computer that can calculate the busy beaver sequence. They're not actually possible, but if they were, they still wouldn't be able to determine when they themselves will halt. This computer would be able to tell when another computer will halt, but not when it will halt. See where this is going? A super Turing machine necessitates the existence of a super busy beaver sequence. You can take this up as many steps as you want, past super Turing machines to super duper Turing machines, and that's what Elga and Ryo did. Ryo countered with a super duper busy beaver number, and Elga responded with a super duper pooper busy beaver number. The referees were beginning to frown on this. It wasn't really within the rules of the big number duel, because they were basically just one-upping each other with the same basic idea. So then, Ryo stepped up to the chalkboard, looked Elga in the eye, and finished him. He wrote, "The largest number expressible in the language of first-order set theory with under a Google symbols." First-order set theory is a mathematical language with all sorts of symbols you really don't need to learn about, like upside-down A's and backwards E's and shit. Expressing small numbers in first-order set theory is difficult and cumbersome. You need a lot of symbols just to write one. But bigger numbers are a breeze, because you can express them as the result of various functions. You can write the busy beaver function in first-order set theory. You can write the tree function, another fast-growing function beloved among Googleologists because the third term of the tree function is already larger than Graham's number. The number Ryo used to win the big number duel is the largest number that allows the use of a Google symbols in first-order set theory. So you can nest the tree function inside itself, you can do the busy beaver number for the Googleplexed term of tree, knock yourself out. Interestingly, you can't use Graham's number because of how hard it is to write Graham's number in simplified notation. Think of all the arrows we had to write to get there. Graham's number cannot be expressed with fewer than a Google symbols in first order set theory, but numbers much larger than it can. That's Ryo's number, and because I live in Eugene, Oregon, I think I should call it the duck number, because it beats the beavers. Most mathematicians consider it the largest possible number ever described. Anything bigger is a salad number that just builds on Ryo's idea. In some ways, that's our answer. That's where numbers get too big for math to describe them. But is the duck number a number? Or is it just a concept? Is it the idea of a number? Googology Wiki itself casts some doubt on the legitimacy of the big number duel. Atop the page for the big number duel, there's a quote from a YouTube video about the duel that says, "Philosophy and mathematics have no place together. Shame on you, MIT, for allowing this garbage. I guess MIT is turning into an art school now. I think the quote is there because even Googleologists find it funny and absurd that A, there was a big number duel, and B, people have strong opinions on whether it constitutes math. But there's a point to that comment. Keep this in mind. Most of the coverage of the big number duel mistakenly described Ryo and Elga as mathematicians. They're not. They're both professors of philosophy. Maybe the largest named number isn't really a good mathematical question. And what's the first digit of the duck number? How about the last? We don't know. Mathematicians don't even know how they'd start finding the exact value of the duck number. What proof is there that any given large number is the largest number expressible with under a Google symbols in first order set theory? It's all very wishy-washy. Ultimately, it isn't much better defined than saying the biggest number my opponent can think of plus one. Dr. Sinha says the constraint he'd put on Googology Wiki if he could would be that you have to place your number on a number line relative to all the other numbers on the site. It has to be calculable enough that you know which other big numbers it's bigger than and which ones it's smaller than. And other than Graham's number, which does have a clear set value that we can calculate more or less, most other things cited as the biggest number don't pass this test. The busy beavers, beyond the fifth term in that function, we have no idea what they are and what they're bigger than or not. How about recursive Graham's number, G Graham's number, the one that I called the Jollibee the Durian number? That's got a clear value, but is the duck number bigger or smaller than that? We don't know. Most of these numbers are just floating around in big number space, unable to be compared to other big numbers or anything tangible. And that's not a number, that's the idea of a number. So then, what's the biggest number for which we know all the digits? There's an answer out there, but I don't think anyone's come up with it. Dr. Sinha certainly didn't know when I asked him. We don't know the exact values of most of the busy beaver numbers. We don't know the exact values for most of the terms of the tree function. We don't even know the exact value of Graham's number. There is a process for calculating the last few digits of Graham's number. We know that it ends in a 7. On the internet, where you can find anything, thank you Al Gore, there exists a 1600-page document detailing the last 16 million digits of Graham's number. Of course, nowhere close to the whole number. The whole number, again, wouldn't fit in the universe, but we also can't calculate the first digit of it without knowing all the rest of the digits first. We will never know the first digit of Graham's number. So, what's the largest number we, and by we I mean humanity, could calculate if we wanted to? There are no clear estimates as to the total computing capacity of humanity, but all our brains working together are probably stronger than all our computers working together. Computer scientists and neurologists alike are quick to mention that the human brain is not a computer, nor is it anything like a computer. It's not easy to take computing terminology and map it onto the workings of a human brain, but I can tell you this with some confidence. If all 8 billion humans were to gather in the Australian outback and use their collective brain power to function as single neurons in one vast brain, think childhood's end, then we still wouldn't be able to calculate Graham's number within the expected age of the universe. We wouldn't be able to reach a Googleplex either, and that's assuming that 8 billion human brains working together create a brain 8 billion times more powerful than humanity, which isn't very human. This whole hypothetical doesn't really say a lot about free will. It's just as fantastical as a super Turing machine. What's the largest number you can get to without counting? Like, how many fingers am I holding up right now? You know it's 5, right? But you presumably didn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, oh, Tor's holding up 5 fingers, right? You just went, yeah, that's 5. Being able to immediately grasp the number of things there are is called subitizing, and most people can subitize up to a maximum of 5 to 7 objects. Look at these pennies I have glued to my wall. There are 22 totals. There are 4 to the right of the light switch and 18 to the left. But you can see that there are 4 right away, and you probably only got to 18 once I said there were 22 total. But were you going to count all the pennies left of the light switch? Probably not, right? You were going to group them into bunches of 3, 4, or 5, groups that you can subitize and count them like 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18. Subitizing makes counting faster, even when you're counting numbers too big to subitize. Being able to subitize huge numbers is a common stereotype of autistic people. probably because it was featured in Rain Man, the winner of Best Picture at the 1989 Oscars.
Let me check. Sorry about the toothpicks.
82 what?
How much is this?
Toothpicks.
It's a lot more than 82 toothpicks, right?
Plus 246 total.
Let me change. Ray, how many toothpicks are you?
250.
Pretty close. Come on, let's go, Ray.
246.
There's four left in the box.
In reality, the ability to do this is so rare, there are only a few documented cases in existence. In general, autistic people actually have slightly lower subitizing abilities than neurotypicals. Dustin Hoffman's character in Rain Man is based on Kim Peek, a savant from Utah whose mind was so unique, people now don't even think he was autistic. The exact scene in Rain Man was probably inspired by neurologist Oliver Sacks' 1985 book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, in which he describes fascinating and strange medical cases he's had. In one chapter, Sacks recounts a story of meeting a pair of autistic savant twins who could subitize hundreds of matches dumped on the floor, immediately counting 111. This aspect of Sacks' story has been called into question by other scientists. The largest number an average person can teach themselves to subitize with the right training is probably around 10. People, autistic or otherwise, who can perfectly subitize large numbers are practically a neurological cryptid. What's the largest number a human being can imagine? It's pretty damn low. Guess your city's population right now. Now look it up. Unless you live in a very small town, you'll probably be off by at least a few thousand. Maybe if you live in a big city, you might be off by up to a million. And you probably won't be surprised by that. By the time you get up into the thousands, you sorta implicitly accept that all big numbers are more or less the same. Now, what you're counting affects how big a number you can comprehend. A city of a million people is way bigger than a city of 100,000 people. I think we can all understand that. Harder to understand is how much bigger $1 billion is than $1 million, since most of us will never have anywhere close to either of those amounts. Archimedes referred to an unimaginably large number as a sand hundred. That is, something as uncountable as grains of sand. Everything reaches a point where it becomes like grains of sand. But I think the average biggest number a human can wrap their mind around, independent of the thing being counted and the math ability of the person in question, is remarkably low. Somewhere in the low hundreds, I'd say. Which makes sense. Did evolution set us up to deal with gigantic numbers? God no. What's the biggest number our ancestors on the savannah would ever deal with? The only number over 100 that comes to mind is 365 days in the year. And even then, I doubt a lot of Pleistocene hunter-gatherers knew that number with perfect accuracy. That's pretty close to the biggest number I think a modern human can intuitively grasp the size of. That pissed off MIT student on Googology Wiki was right. This isn't math anymore. This is philosophy. Somehow, it almost seemed easier when we were talking about power towers and busy beavers. There, at least, there's a clear factual answer, even if we'll never know it. But it's not like this wasn't an iffy question from the start. We knew what the answer was from the start. There is no answer. There is no biggest number. As a species, we've done a fair amount of plumbing the mysteries of the universe, but ultimately, the biggest number nature ever expected us to deal with is somewhere around 365. Picture this. You're in a helicopter, swooping low over the Andes in Peru. The land is maybe 13,000 feet in elevation. You're flying several thousand feet above that. You can't really conceptualize how high that is, but as you fly over a steep, snowy ridge, you see a vast mountain lake come into view, gleaming in the sun in front of you. The helicopter drops a few thousand feet in elevation so that you're close enough to the waters of the lake, you can clearly see two people in a canoe. And there, behind them, you see 365 llamas on 365 islands. Can you picture that? I know I can.